Passover is one of the gateway festivals for new believers or people who are coming into the Hebraic walk. Passover as well as Sukkot. Sukkot is another one of those gateway festivals. And it seems like there's a lot of people who start to come and observe Passover or want to observe Passover and want to observe Sukkot even though they're not even observing the Sabbath. Or maybe even while they're still eating unclean foods or things like that, they still want to take part in Passover for some reason. And I would submit one of the reasons is because it's pretty close to Easter. And so it's something that they can associate with real easily, and it sort of has a theme that they can align themselves with. But it's good that people want to do these things. They want to go ahead and start. I remember back when I was a kid, we were living in a trailer park, and next door to us was this fellow and his wife. And his wife was really into this walk, but the fellow wasn't at all. And they had a couple of kids and stuff. And so his wife talked him into going to the feast at that year. That was 1969. And then, of course, our family living next door to them, we were sort of encouraging them to come as well. And as a result of him coming to the feast that year, he met a lot of fellows like himself who had come into it various ways. But bottom line, he realized this is something I can actually do. And so he came into it and is very strong in that walk. He continued in that walk after the feast and became very strong in the walk for a long time. And then you run across people also who they learn a little bit about Passover, and then they want to go and participate in a Jewish Seder. And so there's a lot of people around who sponsor big Jewish Seders, and they'll invite you to it. And when they go to a Messianic Jewish Seder, what they find out is that Passover, the Jewish Passover, has a lot of Messianic overtones to it that they catch that most people don't catch. And so there again, it's a good way to get started into this, to learn a little bit more about it. But there's also some things that we need to be careful about in regards to Passover, and we need to think about as well, and we start talking about and observing Passover. So in this message, I want to touch on what Passover is, and I also want to touch on some lessons that we, those of us who are striving to walk in His ways, can learn about Passover and learn about the observance of it as we strive to walk in the footsteps of our Messiah. So, to start off, Passover is the first festival in the yearly 7-year cycle. Now, if you go to Leviticus 23, it says, "And the Yahweh spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, The feast of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Now, if you studied that passage before, you've also realized that the first festival that's listed is the Sabbath. All right, but the Sabbath is not a yearly festival, it's a weekly festival. So we're going to talk about the yearly festivals, the ones that only come around once in a year. And of those yearly festivals, the first that is listed is Passover. In this passage here, the word feast is listed twice. You see them there circled. And the Hebrew word there for feast is moed. And it's Strong's number 51, or 4150, as you'll see. Now moed is a word that basically means to appoint. It's an appointed time. We understand it to be an appointed time. And in this, the way it's written here, the word moed is a noun. But all nouns come from verbs, and so the verb that which moed comes from is the word ya'ad, Hebrew word ya'ad. And you can see here from the vowel pointing that it is indeed a root word, and it's actually in the call form. It's the most basic form of a Hebrew root word. And ya'ad means specifically to appoint, to assemble, and to betroth. And so, with the betrothal aspect of it, and realizing that in the Hebrew culture, a betrothal took place in the presence of witnesses, and you would invite people to your betrothal. Most of us don't do that today unless we're at a bar or something like that. And you've seen those things where people get betrothed at a bar and it's a dare or something like that. Well, that's not the way the Hebrews do it. The Hebrews do it by taking and inviting people over, and they have a ceremony for betrothal, and usually is accompanied by a breaking of a glass of wine, and it's also, or of a wine glass, and also a sign of the ketubah. So these are all aspects of the festivals, of the feast, and we can see the understanding of that in the word Ya'ad. But the important thing for us to realize is that it's betrothal. And when you are betrothing yourself to somebody, you tend to want to be with them from that point forward. That's sort of the reason for the betrothal. So you tend to want to be in it, or want to be with the person you are betrothing yourself to. And so this is why you have these appointed times. These are times for you and your betrothed one to come together. Now, the other words in here is holy convocations, and the phrase there in Hebrew is Mikra Kodesh, Strong's number 4744 and 6944. And Mikra, well, we know what Kodesh is. Kodesh means holy. So it's a set-apart Mikra. And a Mikra literally means a reading, a calling together, or an assembly. So the Mikra is a time to do a reading, to read something specifically for the appointed time. Now the word Mikra is a word that we've been reading a lot, comes from a root word that we've been reading a lot in regards to the sacrifices. And that word is the word, the word is Karav. I guess I didn't put it up there. It's the word Karav. It's Strong's number 7121, I think. I got five digits down here, and it's only four. But you can find it, Karav. And Karav is the root word from which we get the Hebrew word that we've been talking about here for the last 3 weeks, Korban. It's the word you get Korban from. And Korban is the offerings, okay? So, and the purpose for the offerings is to do what? Is to draw near. So all this is tied up in this concept of drawing near. So the convocations are there, the holy convocations are set apart times to draw near to God. And while you're drawn near, then what you are to be doing is reciting and reading. And what would you be reading? You'd be reading the words of God. And you read these things in the presence of the assembly, because that's the whole concept behind the Moed. Now, Strong's uses a word that sort of describes this whole concept, and it's called rehearsal. The word is rehearsal. And even though you don't necessarily find that in the in-depth meaning of the word Korah, or in the word Mikra, which is derived from Korah, the concept of rehearsal is probably the best thing. Because what you do on these set-apart times is you come together to rehearse something, and you either rehearse something that's happened before or rehearse something that's getting ready to happen. If you rehearse a play, you're going to give the play pretty soon. But sometimes we rehearse things that have already happened, and that's the concept behind the word Karav. Now, the first three there's seven festivals, and the first three are Passover, Hag HaMatzah, or the Days of Unleavened Bread, and Shavuot, which is Pentecost. And these three festivals all picture things that have happened in the past, but we also know that they also symbolize things that will happen in the future as well. But for the most part, when we look at these festivals, these are behind us, okay? And we know that Passover so far has had two fulfillments, and it's going to have another fulfillment in many ways, at least in regards to the Exodus that's associated with that. So you got the three festivals that are behind us, and then you got the four festivals are yet to come. Now these are festivals that pretty much take place in the future, though Yom Teruah and Yom Kippur to some degree have been taking place. Someone mentioned Yom Kippur today, I think it was Dan. Mentioned Leviticus 16. But these are all festivals that we look at, and as we study these things, they are going to be things that come, will be coming in the future. And of course, the culmination of these festivals then should lead to the coming of the Messiah. And so this is what we look forward to, and this is why we keep the festivals. Now, Because God laid out the festivals in a circular pattern like this, where we go through the festivals, and then after we're through with Shemini Atzeret, we start looking forward to Passover again. Then we have this constant rehearsal of the plan of God. And when we put the plan of God or the festivals and combine them with the fact that most of these things have or will signify or be associated with a historical event, then we begin to understand the plan of God, the plan of salvation for God, you might say, or basically the plan of how God is going to bring His people to the promised land. And so trying to take and understand how God is working with His people and how they are going to make it ultimately to the promised land and ultimately to where we see Messiah return, we can't understand that without the festivals. Because this is what they were for. And you're missing the major key to understanding what God is doing if you do not do so in the context of the festivals. Now, like I said, the festivals roughly match the history of God's people Israel. And so we'll take a little bit of time and look through that. In the meantime, just see that these are cycles. These are things that just go on and on. Passover came about as a result of a prophecy that God made with Abraham. And so this is one we're going to look at predominantly today, Passover. It came about as a result of a promise that God made to Abraham. You'll remember that Abraham had been told to leave Ur of the Chaldees and come, and that God was going to make a great nation out of him. But at the time that God had done so, Abraham had no children. But then in Genesis 15, God told Abraham that he was indeed going to have a child. And Abraham believed that God was going to give him a child, and God says that that was accounted to him as righteousness, right? All right, well, let's read a little bit about what God did say to Abraham at that point, because this prophecy that God gave to Abraham is basically what set in motion the whole Passover cycle, or the Passover events. So let's look here in Genesis 15. We'll look at verses 13, 14, and 16. Then Yahweh said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in the land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions." And then dropping down to verse 16, "And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Well, where was here when God was talking about this? The here was there in the vicinity of Mount Moriah and stuff like that. The bottom line, basically though, what we're trying to get at is that they're going to come back to Israel, because Abraham was in Israel when this prophecy was given. So this is the cutting of the covenant. This whole episode here that Abraham was a part of was called the cutting of the covenant. And so what we see is that God will take, and anything He does then in regards to Passover is associated with this covenant that God had made to Abraham. And there, again, to separate Passover from the covenant that God made to Abraham leaves you void of understanding, because everything that God did in regards to Israel, in regards to the Passover and the Exodus from Egypt, was because of the covenant that God made with Abraham. So we have to keep that in that context. And we see that is exactly what God did. God started the events of Passover because of the covenant. We see that in Exodus 2, verses 23 through 24, where it says, "Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage." Now pay attention here, because this is the key. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So it's because God heard their groaning that He remembered the covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it was because of the covenant that He began to set things in motion that caused the freedom of the Israelite people. So being in covenant with God was key to this festival. God didn't go out and start freeing the world, because there's more than just one nation under bondage, I'm sure, at that time. He chose one people to free, and that one people were the people who were in His covenant. Now, the Israelites weren't necessarily walking in the covenant, and I would submit that they were probably wrapped up in paganism. But nevertheless, they were God's covenant people, and so God set out to free His covenant people because of the covenant. The covenant was the big thing. So, okay, we'll go to this. So God went ahead, and we're not going to go through all the details of the Passover, but you know what happened. And in the Passover story, actually as the events of Passover were unfolding, God made this statement, and it's really important because in the statement God makes, He puts a restriction on Passover. And many people don't understand or realize that this is the case, but God is the one who put a restriction on Passover, and specifically what some people could or could not do in regards to Passover. And it's in Exodus 12, verse 43. And it says, Yahweh said to Moshe and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover, no foreigner shall eat it. Now, I interjected in here the Hebrew words, translated Hebrew words, and where it says no foreigner, that the Hebrew word there is ben necker, or son of a stranger. Now, you can go back through the text and look up some of these things, and a ben necker, or a son of a stranger, is a person who is a part of Israel. In other words, they're living in the land of Israel, but they have no regards for the God of Israel. And they, in fact, may be opposed to the God of Israel. And so why would a person who is opposed or has no regard for the God of Israel, why would they want to keep Passover? They would do it just in spite. Okay? They would do it just to degrade it or something like that. It'd be sort of like us keeping Ramadan. Okay? Why would we keep Ramadan? Because we'd make fun of it or something like that. So this is the point behind a ben necker. And then it says a sojourner, and the word there is tashav, is a resident alien. A tashav and a hired servant, which is a sakir, a person hired from another nation, shall not eat of it. Now the tashav, again, is a resident alien, but there's someone who are there. There again, they have no real regards for the God of Israel at all. They're just there. Okay, they're just in the land. They're in there, basically enjoying the blessings that God is giving Israel. They want to associate only as much as they can to get the blessings of it. And I would call that a person who is multiculturally minded. They want to come and enjoy the blessings of Israel, but they don't want to join the culture of Israel. We have that today in our country. A lot of people want to come to America, but they don't want to become Americans. They want to maintain whatever background or whatever they're from. So this is the type of person that God would say not. And then a sakir, a person hired from another nation, is generally a mercenary. That's a person who has been hired to come into the land, or maybe they're a hired worker. We have that in, like Jason, when he went and he spent some time in the United Arab Emirates, and over there they had hired people who came in and they just came there to work and then they left. So that's what a sakir is. So these people here cannot eat the Passover. God did not allow them to keep Passover. And the reason would be is because they would basically, they had no need for the Passover. They had no understanding of the Passover. And the Passover, if they were to keep it, would have degraded the Passover because they were doing it for fun, you might say. So these are the persons that could not. But on the other hand, God did say that some people could, even though they were not native Israelites, they could keep the Passover. Exodus 12, 48. And when a stranger or a ger, and the Hebrew word ger actually means a newcomer without inheritance rights. When a ger dwells with you and wants to keep the Passover to Yahweh, Let all his males be circumcised, and let him come near, or karav. We see that word karav again. And keep it, and he shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. So basically what God is saying here is a ger, or someone who is new to the walk, but yet they don't have inheritance rights. In other words, they're not born in the land, or they have not married into a family that would have an inheritance. But they do want to be a part of Israel. And they do want to be a part of the culture of Israel. And they would give anything to do so. So they're going to give part of their foreskin to do so. They're going to give up a little bit of them in order to be a part of keeping Passover. Because Passover has a special meaning for them. Now the other implication of this, or actually say a qualification, is that they would draw near. So a person who draws near is a person who associates and wants to associate with God. They want to take and come up. They want to be a part of the people of God. And so this is a example of a person who would want to come in. So with that said, we also have the understanding that when you take and marry into a family, you become part of that family. When you have children, you become part of that family. And so children and your mates and those, they come in because of you. They are part of your family. And this would be an understood thing because the persons in the family, usually the head of the household, is the one who leads. Have you ever thought about the fact, this is a side note, I don't have it written down. Did you ever think about the fact that because women could not be circumcised, then the way that they are part of the covenant is through their husbands? Just a side note. Why didn't God, as a sign of the covenant, do something that both men and women could join into and be a part of? I don't know. So I would submit that God had in his mind that it's always going to be a family thing. That to become Israel is to become a family or be a part of a family. All right, so the persons that God didn't want to be keeping Passover are those who had no regard for Israel and no regard for the things that God had done for Israel. He did not want people taking and eating a part of a lamb or a piece of a lamb that symbolized the death of his son or some animal that died so that the Israelites could be free. Because to take those sacrifices and eat them without the understanding of what was given up for the freedom of Israel would not have been the right thing to do. So, God is saying, if you want to keep the Passover, you must honor the sacrifice that was made. And again, we keep this in mind too, is that at the time of the first Passover, how many of the Israelites were following the ways of God? None of them. But they did know this. They knew they were in covenant. They knew they had a covenant bond with Abraham and with the God of Abraham. And as a part of that bond with Abraham, one of the things they would have eventually had to realize is that one of the reasons God chose Abraham and made the covenant with Abraham is because God knew this about Abraham. God says, I know that he, Abraham, will order his sons and his house after him, and they will keep the ways of Yahweh to do justice and judgment, that Yahweh may bring them upon Abraham all things whatsoever he has spoken to him. What God is saying here is that all the things that God had said that he was going to do for Abraham will only happen if the sons and the houses after him, if they will keep the ways of Yahweh. So there has to be training. There has to be a people who are willing to walk in the ways. But because God knew Abraham would teach his sons and generations after that would teach their children to walk in God's ways, then that's why the covenant was made with Abraham. All right. So, where am I? So we have a lesson. Our first lesson is this, that Passover is for God's covenant people. Anyone who truly wants to walk in the ways of Yahweh is shown, as we're illustrated by the one seed of Abraham, which is Messiah Yeshua. So if you're wanting to walk in God's ways, let me submit this to you. There's a lot of people who want to walk, but don't know the walk. They don't know how to walk it yet. They're just learning. But those who are, as they learn and walk, this is what God is looking for. So, let's now look at Passover's role in the festivals. The festival of Passover is all based on the Goel, or the kinsman redeemer. And we haven't gotten to those passages yet in our Torah study for this cycle. But the Hebrew word Goel is from the root word Ga'al, which means to be a kinsman. And the purpose behind a kinsman was twofold. One was to buy back the brother or near relative that had sold himself or had been sold into slavery. And there's a number of reasons why a person would sell themselves into slavery back then. But if you had sold yourself into slavery or you'd found yourself in slavery, then it was the responsibility of the Goel to take and buy you back. Another reason for the Goel was to avenge the blood of the brother. So if my brother is killed, then it's my responsibility to avenge the blood of my brother. Obviously, we can't do that today. I put that on the tape so no one's thinking we're trying to kill anybody. But that if we had been living in those days, that would have been our responsibility as a Goel. Now, God is going to become the Goel for Israel. And we see this in Exodus 6, verse 6. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am Yahweh. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. And here the word again is Goel. So the purpose behind Passover and the main message of Passover is that of redemption, buying back a people who had sold themselves into slavery. Now, how did God go about buying Israel back? Well, He did that basically by taking and making a distinction between Israel and Egypt. Now think about it. There was 10 plagues. Only the first three plagues did Israel take part in. After the first three plagues, Israel was exempt. God specifically set Israel apart and made a distinction between Israel and the Egyptians. And then when it came down to the 10th plague, Israel now, the individual people had an opportunity to set themselves apart. God did not go down and force the Israelites to take and kill a lamb and put the blood on the doorpost. Every Israelite family had to make that decision on their own. But when they did make that decision to put the blood on the doorpost, then a distinction was made between them and anyone who did not have the blood on the doorpost. And we would assume that because a mixed multitude came out, that maybe some of the Egyptians had chosen to join in with Israel and put the blood on the doorpost and save their firstborn. We know very clearly that by that time, many of the Egyptians had become to believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which indeed was the reason, or one of the reasons why God did all the plagues, is that the people would begin to understand that He indeed was Yahweh. So this distinction was made, covering the entrance to the home, made that house distinct from the other houses, and thus when the angel came over, before the angel got over their house, that would the destroyer, then Yahweh would basically stretch Himself out over that house and not let them come in. And so He provided that covering for that house to keep the destroyer from coming in and taking the lives of the firstborn. So our second lesson in regards to Passover is that Yahweh has karat us, or He's called us, to be separate from the Egyptians. So as part of Passover, we should learn that we've got to be distinct. We've got to be separate. We've got to be different from the rest of the world. And so if you're striving to be like the world, then you may have a difficult time with Passover because those are distinct people. They're different from the rest of the world. Now, the third thing we want to talk about is children. The Passover story tells us often that we are to teach our children. In fact, children were very much a part of the Passover message. I would submit that the reason that God had the lamb brought into the homes on the 10th day of Nisan and stayed there for 4 days was to help involve the children in the Passover story. So the children were brought in, and they were a part of that. And God continually tells us to take and teach our children. And in Exodus 12, it says, "And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance." And here we're talking about the entire Passover story. God had given all the instructions to the elders of Israel about killing the lamb and even the days of unleavened bread. He'd already talked to them about it. And he says, "And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. And it shall be when your children say to you, 'What do you mean by this service,' this entire Passover service, that you shall say, 'It is the Passover sacrifice of Yahweh who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households.'" And so we're told to instruct our children in all aspects of the Passover story. We're supposed to talk to them about the part dealing with taking the lamb, the subsequent 7 days of unleavened bread. And then he even expands it out to include the consecration of the firstborn, because consecration of the firstborn came about as a result of Passover. And so he says, "And you shall tell your son in that day," speaking about the consecration of the firstborn, "this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that Yahweh's law may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand Yahweh has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year." Does everybody understand what the consecration of the firstborn was? Okay, the consecration of the firstborn was when God said that if you have a firstborn that opens the womb, you are to take and give an offering for it, or you're supposed to sacrifice it if it's a clean animal, and if it's not, you are to redeem it. And if it's a male child, then you are to redeem the male child. That's the consecration of the firstborn thing. And so when you're doing that, you got one that comes out, you know, just born and 2 or 3 days old, then you have to take and sacrifice it if it's like a lamb. And so you take and do it with your child there, and you tell your children why you're doing this. Why are you taking this newborn lamb and taking its life? Because God said to do it, and it's all part of the Passover story, because this came into being because the firstborn of Israel were saved. So this is just another opportunity to teach. Another opportunity is here in verses 14 and 15. "So it shall be when your son asks you in that time, saying, 'What is this?' that you say to him, 'By strength of hand, Yahweh brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that Yahweh killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to Yahweh all the males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem.'" So again, this is an important aspect of Passover, that if we leave this portion out, we've left out Passover. We've left out a lot of the service. And so as we, in our tradition of keeping Passover, in this fellowship, we spend most of the time talking to children, because this is the big portion of the Passover. Now, an interesting point right here that is made in these passages is that God not only tells us that we are free, He tells us how we are to remain free, and He gives that responsibility to us to teach our children. We are to teach our children how to remain free. So we're going to go back to this passage here again, and it says, starting in verse 9, right here, "It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth." Now, what does that mean? What it's saying is God wants you to teach these things to your children, this whole Passover story, over and over and over again, Because by doing so, you impress upon your children what gained your freedom. And then once you understand, and once your children understand what gained their freedom, they are less likely to give up their freedom. And how would they give up their freedom according to the book Deuteronomy? By turning away from this law. So this law will stay in their mouth if we impress upon them the importance of Passover. You know, here in our country, we are slowly going into or losing freedom. And the reason is because we do not recall what it took to gain our freedom. We don't recall over and over again like we used to do in school about our founding fathers and the sacrifices that were made so that we were able to keep, you know, to gain our freedom. And this is all that God is saying Himself. If you don't tell them about how they gained their freedom, they're going to lose their freedom. And eventually that is actually what happened to the Israelites. So the third lesson that we want to go over here is by continually teaching our children about Passover and freedom, we help them preserve their freedom. So very important to continually teach our children about Passover. Now, as Israel was driven out of their homes, and they didn't head directly to the Promised Land, we know that. Instead, they headed south, and they went to a little town called Sukkot to gather the bones of Joseph. And it says in the passage here, then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot besides children. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. Now, they went down there after the bones of Joseph, and they were obligated to do so. But God, why did God plant the bones of Joseph in a place called Sukkot? Okay? Now, Sukkot is a somewhat familiar term, right? Alright, it has to do with the festival, the fall festival. It also has to do with the millennial kingdom. It also is the coming of the Messiah. It pictures the Messianic kingdom after the Messiah has returned. I'm just going to speculate here, and I would say that when they went down there to gather the bones of Joseph at Sukkot, Sukkot was probably a resort. It was probably a place that was nicer than what they had been familiar with. They probably saw maybe a little bit easier, maybe more normal way of life. Maybe they got a little glimpse of utopia when they went to Sukkot. I don't know why, but this is just an interesting point that they make. You know, Eddie Chumney a couple years ago gave a teaching, and he made the point that, as I mentioned earlier, when many people come to this walk, the first thing they do is observe Sukkot. Well, Sukkot has this concept to it that gets people involved in this walk and gets them more committed to this walk. And I would submit that this is what God was trying to do with the children of Israel. They had been redeemed. Now He wanted them to get just a little taste, just a little glimpse of what He wants to give them ultimately. And so He gave that to them by taking them to Sukkot, and then He sent them on down the road. So with that, this is all speculation, so this is a speculation that Passover will keep us focused on the Promised Land. And again, I think all of this together is a very important thing for us to understand and realize. You know, it's interesting about Sukkot and about Passover. There's one individual, Elijah, who is associated with the return of the Messiah, right? Elijah's cup is at every Passover Seder. So maybe the Jewish people understand this as well, that there's a little bit of Sukkot in every Passover. Now there's a lot of other lessons we could learn in regards to Passover. But the last thing I want to talk about is Hag HaMatzah and the Days of Unleavened Bread. Now, we understand, and we understand the story, and we've gone through it a lot, but by tradition, the children of Israel left their homes on the evening of Passover which would have been Nisan 15. And according to tradition, they ended up at the Red Sea sometime on the sixth day. And the scripture makes it a point to say that they came out with a high hand. I would say it's not like this. I would say it's like this. They came out with a high hand with their fist clenched, because I believe that the Israelites, when they came out, they thought that they had actually pulled one over on Pharaoh. That they had beat Pharaoh. They're out from underneath his bonds now, and they're just giving him that, you know, as they're walking out. But they came out with a high hand. Some translations say say high hand. Some say defiantly. Some say boldly. But whatever it was, they thought they had outsmarted old Pharaoh and had now escaped. But as they were going down the road, and as they finally ended up, they found themselves between mountains with a sea in front of them. And lo and behold, behind them was the advancing army of Egypt. And so, though they had all this great expectation, even though they had this high hand and all of this emotion about what they had done and how great they now were, these dreams and these thoughts were soon to be dashed because they were trapped. And they had no way out. Their memories of all the things that God had done for them and the redemption they had received by the blood of this goat or this lamb had all faded behind them now. And I would submit that any one of them at that point, except for just a few, would have quickly and eagerly given up their freedom and gone back into slavery in order to save their lives. In fact, we see that as they continued on down the journey, that they continually wanted to turn back and go back. So they were all ready to turn back. They're all upset with Moses because Moses had brought them out of Egypt. They were redeemed people who had now turned their back on God and turned their back on Moses. But in the height of their despair, Moses, who was faithful to God, made this statement: "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of Yahweh, which He will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again." The problem with the Israelites is that they were redeemed, but they were not saved. They were redeemed, they were not saved. Their enemy was still alive and well. He was bearing down upon them, and they were quickly turning back to him. They were quickly and eagerly willing to go back under the bondage of slavery and underneath the rule of Pharaoh. In our society today, in most Christian circles, we have taught the concept of salvation incorrectly. Because the Hebrew concept of salvation is that you are rescued from your enemy, and then you adore and trust the one who rescued you. The Bible has a number of biblical pictures of that, but two of the most popular ones is that of Jacob and Rachel. Remember, Rachel was at the well. She was being harassed. And so Jacob came in and he lifted this whole top off this well all by himself. Same thing with Moses and Zipporah. Here, Zipporah and her sisters were being harassed at a well by some other shepherds. And so Moses single-handedly comes and drives all those shepherds off. And then what happened? She married him. So the concept of salvation, and by the way, the word salvation is used in that case in its root form of yasha. But yasha actually means to take and be rescued from your enemy and then adore and trust in the one who rescued you. And that will usually, in the biblical sense, lead to marriage. So even though Yahweh had set the Israelites apart from the Egyptians during the plagues, and even though He had spared the firstborn while allowing the death of the Egyptian firstborn, the Israelites still did not believe that God could, would, or if they even wanted Him to deliver them. They just did not have it in their heart. And they did not believe that Yahweh had it in His heart to always do for them what He said He was going to do. They were ready to turn back to bondage. But Moses wasn't ready to turn back. Moses knew what the goal was. The goal was to get to where? Mount Sinai. And eventually to the promised land. And God, as had prophesied to Moses at the burning bush, was that you're going to lead these people and you're going to take them to Mount Sinai. And up to that point, everything that God had told Moses had come to pass. Moses didn't go with blind faith. Moses saw the things that God said He was going to do, and then he saw God do those things. And because he saw God do those things, because he believed that God does not change, would not change, and would fulfill what He said, then Moses was able to make this statement: Yahweh will fight for you, and you only have to be silent. Basically stating to them that all you have to do is shut up, stop murmuring, and watch and see what God will do. And we know what God actually did. He did fight for them in a very unusual way. And Pharaoh and his army both drowned in the sea. Just as the scripture says, thus Yahweh saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that Yahweh used against the Egyptians, so the people feared Yahweh, and they believed in Yahweh and in His servant Moses. I believe this is one of the most important passages in the entire Torah, because this tells us what salvation is. And when we are saved, we're saved when we truly believe and we're truly willing to trust in the one who said He would do something for us, and then believe enough that He will do it to step our foot into that water and go into that, go in there into that water. So the fifth and last lesson of Passover is that Yahweh has redeemed many, but fewer have really been saved. Just because you've been redeemed does not mean you've been saved. You've been redeemed by someone you may not believe in. But until you actually adore Him and walk in His ways, have you truly been saved, according to the scripture here. It often takes a crisis for us to learn to trust in Yahweh, and some people never do trust in Him, but instead return back to Egypt. And it's a sad commentary, but many in this Hebraic walk end up going back to Egypt. They give up on it. They go back in. They give up all the things that they had learned and things that God had blessed them with. They just give it all up. Our redemption should lead us to understand or to hear what God has said, to see what God has done, and then to trust that He will continue to do what He has already done. So redemption, the purpose of redemption, the purpose of Passover then, is for us to understand that God has started something that He will continue if we walk in faith toward Him. So let's go over these lessons again. Passover is for the covenant people. Yahweh has called us to be separate from the Egyptians. We are to continually be teaching our children about Passover and freedom. That Passover keeps us focused on the promised land. And fifth, Yahweh has redeemed many, but fewer are really saved. And so we need to strive to be accounted as part of those who have been saved by trusting in our God and our Creator. As part of His redeemed people, we should observe Passover, unleavened bread, and all Yahweh's festivals in order to truly understand how Yahweh intends to join us to Him in Jerusalem and in the promised land. And with that, I say Shalom Aleichem. And do we have any questions?